You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Mel Williams, represent Don Shumate, the appellant in this matter, on appeal from the City of Martinsville Circuit Court. Mr. Shumate filed a complaint alleging tortious dissemination of his private health information and defamation against members of his employer. He was a police officer, still is a police officer in the City of Martinsville, and a detective. As part of a workers' compensation claim that he filed, he asked his attending physician, his personal doctor, to fill out an attending physician's form. On that form, it asked, what diagnoses does Mr. Shumate have? On that form, the doctor wrote, among other diagnoses, post-traumatic stress disorder. The problem with that is, Mr. Shumate doesn't have a diagnosis for post-traumatic stress disorder, and the doctor later acknowledged that he doesn't have the criteria to satisfy such a diagnosis. It was an error in her part in some way or another. Nonetheless, that form was faxed to the City of Martinsville's workers' compensation carrier, VACORP. An adjuster at VACORP saw that form, was alarmed that a police officer, still working, had been diagnosed with PTSD, and then that adjuster sent the form to the chief of police and to the Human Resources Department at the City of Martinsville. Human Resources Department is not at issue here, but what the chief did with the form is at issue. The chief did first the appropriate thing. He shared it with his command staff. That would be Captain Cassidy and also then Lieutenant Wimmerman. After that, however, the captain and the chief shared that information, shared the diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder with others who had no need to know that information. It was not part of any normal course of business. It was not part of any necessity for those persons to know about investigator.
But at that particular time, did the chief or the captain or the lieutenant know that there had been a mistake on the form?
As alleged in the complaint, they knew or should have known that that was an erroneous diagnosis. In fact, Mr. Shumate worked.
How could they possibly know that other than to second guess a doctor who's reported the diagnosis to the comp carrier?
They would know from their knowledge and interaction with Investigator Shumate over the course of his career with the department.
So you're saying that you've pled a case for defamation to get past qualified immunity on the premise that a police lieutenant, a police captain, and a police sergeant, thank you, should second guess a doctor who is reporting on one of their officers and conclude it must be wrong. I mean, how could they possibly have that duty when they have no evidence it's wrong other than, well, it looks okay to me?
They would have the evidence of their knowledge of Detective Shumate over the course of, at least I believe at that time, an 18-year history with the department, and they're working with him and their knowledge and familiarity otherwise with his health condition. That may be an issue in the defamation claim that could, if they could show that they had no knowledge that it was falsehood, that could defeat the defamation claim, readily acknowledge that. But as the case is now, where it was dismissed by the trial court at the demur and special plea stage, we have the allegations of the complaint taken as true, that they knew or should have known that it was a false diagnosis, that it was not correct. That does not take away from the other count in the action of tortious dissemination of private health information.
May I ask you this question? Am I correct? The trial court said that this diagnosis of PTSD was a statement of opinion, and defamation only lies to statements of fact, not opinion. Am I correct?
The trial court actually relied on a prior ruling it had made in a related case involving a suit that Mr. Shumate filed against the doctor. That case was appealed to this court, and the court has since sent it back, although this court did
not. But there's separate defendants. There's the doctor, and there's these police folks and the city. So the bottom line is, am I correct that this the court in this case with these defendants said this was a statement of opinion and therefore not actionable as defamation?
Yes, I believe that would be an accurate statement of the trial court.
Where do you challenge that on appeal?
That first of all, there's no clear statement of law from this court or any reliable precedent saying that a doctor's opinion cannot be the object of a suit in defamation. Our contention all along has been that there were no facts upon which the doctor could have relied to find that he had a diagnosis for post-traumatic stress disorder. that had she even conducted a cursory review of his medical records, she would have seen that there had been no such diagnosis ever in his history. He'd been a longtime patient of this doctor in her practice prior to her becoming his primary care physician. So therefore, there was
And really, it's sort of what I'm getting at is a somewhat technical point of appellate procedure, which is you have a holding by the trial. I mean, there's alternative holdings, but one of them is a statement of opinion. And it's not clear to me that that's challenged on appeal in your brief.
We challenged all along at the trial court stage and appeal that the statement was false. As certainly is played in the complaint, we've alleged quite clearly that the diagnosis was not true, was not accurate. She later acknowledged it wasn't. So while it is not an explicit error alleged, it certainly is implicit throughout that as played in the complaint, was not a true statement. It was false and can be proven as false, much like the court would be able to identify if someone was accused of having some sort of contagious disease. You could prove that it was false through testing.
Didn't the trial court use qualified immunity in its analysis?
Yes, the court found, held that, certainly as to the defamation claim, that if they had shared, or whatever, however they had shared the information, that they would be entitled to a qualified immunity.
What's wrong with that? Suppose you're the police chief and a doctor and your comp carrier are circulating diagnoses that says he's got a syndrome, and you say to yourself, gosh, I've never personally seen any evidence of this. And I don't really think I believe that personally, but this is what the doctor says. How could it possibly be not within the scope of qualified immunity to say, all right, gentlemen, you need to know this. We have a doctor claiming, stating, opining that one of our officers has a condition we need to consider.
Certainly within the police chief sharing that with his command staff, with the captain, with the lieutenant, perhaps even with a sergeant or other persons who have a reason to know about Detective Shumate's medical and mental health condition, that would be appropriate. However, in this case, and what I believe the trial court totally ignored, is that as pled, it was shared with persons who had no reason to know, persons not even in the department. The trial court opined that perhaps sharing it with the city attorney or someone else in the city.
Who did you claim the information was shared with that would be outside the scope of qualified immunity?
The complaint does not name specific individuals. It says that the chief and that Captain Cassidy shared it with persons within and without the department, is the terms that were used, that had no bona fide need to know. We did not identify those persons specifically, and certainly if the defendants wanted to know whom those persons were.
This is a plea and bar hearing?
Special plea and demur, Your Honor.
Didn't you have to put on that evidence in a plea and bar?
There was no evidence offered at the hearings in that, nor do I believe was it challenged by the defendants as to whom the information was shared with. That came up at the argument at the trial court, and then, of course, the trial court took that and relied on it. It really was not an issue, as I recall, in argument before the trial court. But as pled, it says that the chief and Captain Cassidy shared the information with persons with no need to know. As the defendants would characterize this, the police chief, Captain Cassidy, they would be able to take this information and share it with the whole world. They say that there is no...
But shouldn't there be evidence at a plea and bar hearing? I mean, a plea and bar is not a demur. You don't just look at the pleadings. And when someone raises an affirmative defense, like a statute of limitations or a qualified immunity or qualified privilege, the parties with the burden of proof have to put on evidence. So they put on their evidence. It's within the scope of qualified immunity. And I would have expected to read, yeah, but I have evidence, Your Honor, that it went well beyond the ordinary scope and the ordinary range you would expect this to go. It went to the newspaper. It went to the YMCA staff. It went to all these people that had nothing to do with anything. But that's not in this record.
There was no evidence offered by any person at the hearing on the demurrage.
Then why should the trial judge send this to trial when there's no factual proffer to plea and bar that the qualified immunity is inapplicable when it appears to be facially clearly applicable?
Well, in the absence of any evidence, the court would be left with only the allegations of the complaint. There was no evidence to contradict those. Therefore, as pled, we have information, we have the allegations, the only evidence before the court, that the chief and the captain shared this information with persons who had no right to know, no need to know. That's the only evidence before the court. That certainly would be sufficient to overcome any qualified immunity or qualified privilege, whichever we are calling it. But the trial court ignored that. The trial court simply said, well, maybe it was shared with somebody who may have had some plausible reason to know, but that's not the way the case is pled. That's not any evidence that we have before the court to that effect.
Well, and regardless of who it was shown to, what's the false statement of fact?
The false statement of fact being that Investigator Shoemate has been diagnosed with PTSD when, in fact, he doesn't have such a diagnosis. I'm not sure if I'm missing...
Well, the point is what they shared was a true statement that was on a diagnosis. That wasn't a false statement of fact. It may have been a false statement by Dr. Aaron. It's not them disseminating a false statement.
But
or making a false statement of fact.
As played in the complaint, however, they knew or had reason to know that it was not a true statement. Therefore, that was an issue with the trial court all through, is that the trial court went beyond the facts of the complaint where there was no evidence to the contrary of that and did not accept as true that the defendants knew or should have known that the statement was not true and disseminated it in any event. I acknowledge that that is an issue for the defamation count, that if it is shown through evidence at trial or brought through...
Well, your allegation was Dr. Aaron's statement that Shoemate has been diagnosed with PTSD is a false statement, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And then alleged that the form was faxed to Baycor.
Yes, ma'am.
Then emailed to Defendant Rogers.
Yes, ma'am.
Counsel, is your question been answered? I want to return to the tortious dissemination report that you plead. The statute you rely on, 32.1.127:3, et cetera, is what's known euphemistically as little HIPAA. After the federal government enacted HIPAA, states were not required to parrot that language, but if they didn't, there were significant consequences for their healthcare facilities. So consequently, the General Assembly, beginning in 1997 and actually amending it virtually every year since then, it seems, has refined the HIPAA mirror image statute. It's pretty clear from reading that statute that the intention was relating solely to healthcare providers, to institutional healthcare providers, and that the enforcement mechanism, the club that would be used, was licensure. Although the health department, the state health director obviously can act when there's an egregious violation. This court has not been really keen on creating new torts through the years. Perhaps Bowman versus State Bank of Keysville is the last one I can remember. I was a young attorney then, and I'm not a young attorney now. Give me your best shot at why a regulatory regime that it relates specifically to HIPAA somehow would create a new tort for an individual.
First, as I believe we argued in the reply brief, is that while those statutes, the Virginia Code and the HIPAA statute, were cited as evidence of a duty, we do not rely on that statute, the little HIPAA statute, for the basis of the tort. In fact, the case that has been discussed with much vigor in this case, the Fairfax Hospital case, was decided before that Virginia Code section went into effect. And that case was the same year as the General Assembly adopted that code section. So while the little HIPAA and HIPAA itself may be evidence of the duty that imparts to persons to protect private health information,
the duty that runs directly to healthcare providers, and in this instance, institutional healthcare providers.
Absolutely, with regard to that, but there also is different language or different words used in the Virginia statute referring and distinguishing between healthcare providers versus persons. And much like the HIPAA statute, while it largely focuses on healthcare entities, it certainly has covered entities that go beyond that, as at least one circuit court in the Commonwealth has acknowledged that a law firm could be sued for not sending the subpoena notice to the person whose records they subpoenaed. That was found to be a valid cause of action by a circuit court. Also, the Virginia Code section upon which we rely mentions persons. However, the tort itself would exist still, even if that code section did not exist, as acknowledged by Fairfax Hospital, which came about before that code section even existed. And my time just expired, but unless there are any other questions, I'll take my leave.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jim Gwynn. I'm here on behalf of the City of Martinsville and the individual defendants Rogers, Cassidy, and Wimmer, who have been referred to as the police department defendants. As was pointed out earlier, the chief of police, as well as several members of the command staff. There are a number of, I guess we'll start at the beginning. And the beginning in the brief and the beginning in the case was the idea that there is a tort that lies against an individual in the Commonwealth of Virginia for dissemination of medical information. And the basis would appear to be Section 32.1-127:03, which, as Justice Mims just pointed out, doesn't apply to individuals, doesn't seem to indicate that it applies to individuals, and frankly has no definition or inclusion within it of a method for vindicating, so to speak, rights under that. In other words, if it is a statute that creates a tort, it creates no remedy against an individual. And I would submit to the court that since there hasn't been a tort created by this court since the Bowman case, that this is not the time and place to create a tort based upon a statute that doesn't create the tort against individuals, and based upon the facts in this case as they are alleged.
Why wouldn't the word persons in one section, when generally they're using health care entities, indicate that that person is other than a health care entity?
It does not include in that, Your Honor, anything that defines persons being different than institutions. In addition, it...
The fact that they use a different word would indicate that it might mean something different than a healthcare institution.
Agreed. But there's also not any other reference within the statute that talks to the remedy against individuals or speaks to how an individual is bound, what the duty that the individual has, plus the remedy in the event that the individual violates the duty. It's simply a matter of speaking to regulatory sorts of issues that would appear to apply to institutions. I would also submit that persons are, in that context, and we could get pretty deep into HIPAA here, into definitions and the like, but at this point, without the definition of persons specific in the statute, I would submit that they would be folks who are involved in health care.
Actually, the Virginia Code defines persons in Title I when it's not defined elsewhere, and it's everybody. So part of them need to respond beyond health care. So.
In that event, I would submit that because regardless of whether it's the institution or regardless of whether it's the person, Your Honor, I would submit to the court that there's no remedy that's been placed here. Thus, to the extent that any sort of tort has been created, the only remedy that's established in the statute is the regulatory remedy, the complaint administratively, and that there's no administrative remedy that's put forth against persons.
Why isn't his argument that a la Fairfax, if there is a breach, if there is a duty, if there are damages, then you have a garden variety tort?
Because Fairfax was not based upon the statute. Fairfax was based upon the common law duty that a healthcare provider has, that the records of treatment, the advice given by the doctor, are privileged. The concept under Fairfax was, when you go to the doctor, you don't expect that your, in most instances, you don't expect that your medical treatment, the documentation of it, is going to be disseminated. In this case, you've got a situation where you go to the doctor specifically to get a diagnosis connected with a workers' compensation case that you know has to be disseminated, not only through the workers' compensation system, but also to your employer and to an insurer.
But his argument is, aside from persons within his chain of command who might have a need to know, he has alleged that there was dissemination beyond that to persons with no bona fide need to know.
Your Honor, that allegation is made both for the defamation and the dissemination case. And in the dissemination case, we don't have, because we are in, or because the plaintiff is asking the court to be in the creation stage for torts, we have no basis at this point on how it's pled or what have you. And I would submit to the court that one of the flaws in this pleading has been that the defamation claim is not as specific as required by previous decisions of the court. In creating this...
Well, that was the trial court's ruling on the subject that we talked about quite a bit with appellant's counsel, which is at no point in the pleading or in the plea and bar hearing did the plaintiff ever say, look, in this outer orbit of disinterested people, here's what was said. And for all we know, it was simply, we got a comp claim in from Mr. Shoemate. But it's not in the pleading. And that was the basis of the trial court's holding. Not that it can be disseminated to anyone everywhere, no matter what. It's not before the court. Am I right or wrong on that?
Right. No, you are right, Your Honor. And that's been the sort of the bugaboo, so to speak, about the pleading is without having any allegation as to who these outside people are, there's no basis on which to determine whether or not the qualified privilege would have applied. And so I would submit that since they have the obligation.
What was said to the outside people?
Right.
But it has to be what was said. It doesn't, if I'm looking at Federal Land Bank and what the court said, he's not saying you have to tell us who. Good pleading requires that the exact words spoken or written must be set out. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so didn't he allege that they disseminated the document? And within the document is what he is alleging is the false statement. So wouldn't that be what was said? If the document is speaking, that be what was said?
And that's the, I think that's a concern that we get back to in the questioning for appellant's counsel, which is, isn't that what you would expect to happen within a police department? And
I'm not so much taking issue with within the police department, and I think he may have said some words today that might concede he's really not taking issue with that either. It's the beyond the police department.
And we don't know who the beyond the police department is.
But does Federal Land indicate that you have to say that? And I understand Justice Kelsey's questions about this is a plea and bar, but Federal Land says you have to say what was said.
Yes, Your Honor. And I thought later on in the opinion it also mentioned who and when.
I think you said you could get that by a bill of particulars.
And under the circumstances, without saying what else is involved here other than the document was given to somebody, it's not specific enough under Federal Land Bank. Our position would be that if that is all that has been done, then there's no defamation claim here. Because you've got a doctor's opinion that is given to you in the course of the workers' compensation claim that you've shared, and there's no indication that it's defamatory from the standpoint of having all the hallmarks of what a defamation case has.
He doesn't plead, if I'm right, that he knows, that the defendant knows, that the doctor was wrong. He's only saying, here's what the doctor says, but the disseminator didn't believe it. Well, where is, going back to Justice Plenian's question, where is the statement of fact? Suppose I were to say to my colleague, I learned something from somebody, and they said this happened to somebody. I personally don't believe it, but this is what was said. Where's the defamation in that?
That's the point I think that we've made in our brief, Your Honor, is that when you look at what is required under defamation, that it's not an actionable statement. As you describe it, and as it's described in the pleading, it's not an actionable statement because it doesn't meet those requirements that have been set forth.
Well, I'm sorry, what's not an actionable statement? That he had PTSD?
Well, that's kind of the problem with the lack of clarity in the pleading. If the statement is that he had PTSD, then I would submit to the court that it's not an actionable statement. It is an opinion. It is the doctor's opinion. It is given to these...
Mr. Gwynn, I hope I'm not calling you by the name, wrong name. Counsel, aren't we back, when you make that statement, to where we were in the original case that came before us, where it seems that the trial court, and unless I'm missing something, then that perhaps you are too, he's not saying that there is a diagnosis of PTSD that is an opinion that's false. He's saying PTSD is written on a form, but there was never a diagnosis of PTSD. So it is a false statement.
By the doctor.
Correct. Which, if you disseminate it, it's still a false statement. It's just whether they knew or had reason to know, which he alleges that they did, which he may not be able to prove, that it was a false statement. It's still a false statement, isn't it?
Based on that, it's certainly alleged to be a false statement. I don't think I'm in a position to concede today.
Right, and I'm not asking you to concede. No, I'm not asking you to concede. But if it begins out as a false statement written on a piece of paper and I give it to Justice Mims and he gives it to the chief, it is no less false passed down the line.
Correct, I agree. The question then becomes whether or not under federal land bank there's been a pleading other than the conclusory statement that they knew or should have known that it was false, that they had any reason to conclude that it was false. And I would submit that based upon what the pleading requirements are in federal land bank, that at least had to be pled to show that these police officers had some reason. And
does the allegation say the police chief or lieutenant or captain is saying this man has this condition? Or is the allegation simply that those three men said, a doctor says he has this condition, which is absolutely true. A doctor said that.
I don't believe that is set out there in the pleading.
Isn't that the whole problem?
Yes.
The defamation for these three men would be, a doctor said this, and I can tell you from my own experience, for sure he has it, because of this, that, and the other. When it's completely false, it's not opinion, and allegations of material fact are fabricated. But the communication here by these three defendants appears to be simply repeating what someone else has said, which is true. A doctor did say that. And whether the person agrees or disagrees with what the doctor said is really beside the point.
Provided that the statement is solely, this is what the doctor said.
Right.
They don't go beyond that. I would agree.
Is there any allegation in the pleading that these three defendants said, this is what the doctor said, and I completely agree with it. He has this condition, no doubt.
There is no allegation in the pleading of any specificity as to what was said by the defendants to anybody.
Well, in fact, the allegations are he showed the form. He told persons about the reported diagnosis, gave the form to Wimmer, made copies of the form and distributed it.
There's no...
The form may have a false statement in it, but distributing the form is not a false statement.
I wouldn't think so. Certainly without anything other than the distribution of the form. Now, if there's some other comment that has not been pled, we can't do anything about that today. It simply wasn't pled, and the trial court, based upon what was in the pleading before him, made the appropriate decision in the defamation case. I would submit that he also made the appropriate decision under the dissemination case, recognizing where we are with the Fairfax Hospital case, recognizing the statute, but I would submit to the court that because that statute does not create a tort in and of itself, because it doesn't have a remedy, and because it doesn't set forth, it's not self-executing, basically. And so you don't have a situation where statute tells you how to go about vindicating your rights or whatever under it, other than through the administrative process. And I would submit that under the circumstances, workers' compensation case, PTSD diagnosis, police worried about, I think it's obvious that the police were concerned about arming someone with PTSD, that this is not the case for the court to create the tort that the plaintiff is asking to be created. And I would, for those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm.
Before you sit down, what do you have to say about Justice McCullough's observation that there's an independent grounds for the trial court's decision, namely that this was opinion, not fact, and that that's not alleged as an assignment of error.
I agree that I can't find in the brief that the that plaintiff's counsel has addressed the trial court's decision that it was opinion. There is the other case against the doctor in which that right. decision was called into question. That's not this case. And to the extent that it's not this case, then I would submit that that it hasn't been preserved and that that particular part of the decision would stand because it hasn't been challenged.
Well, is the decision that it's not opinion from the other case with at least one of the parties the same, not all of them?
Only one defendant.
I'm trying to figure out how what legal mechanism you would use. You don't have the same parties involved. You have one party that's the same, but not the same parties. How do you? It's a difficult question to ask. How do you transfer a decision that we have already made about that statement to a case that is another case, but doesn't have the mechanism for collateral estoppel, res judicata, etc.?
Separate case numbers, law of the case. Maybe.
That may be the simplest way to put it. Otherwise, I don't know. You've got two different cases. You've got a decision in one case. You've got the law of the case in both cases. And they don't, on that particular issue, they don't match.
What about the fact that the trial judge specifically appears to rely on the prior decision? Plaintiff alleges that Dr. Aaron was mistaken in her diagnosis, but the court has ruled in a companion case that this diagnosis, however erroneous, is an expression of opinion by the treating physician, by the plaintiff's treating physician. So the doctor seems to be relying on the prior decision to reach this decision.
He certainly is making the same decision in both cases, Your Honor, that it's opinion. And I think that, you know, again, when I, you know, when you start trying to read minds as to what judges were intending, you probably get in trouble, but it seems to me that that was shorthand for saying, in this case, it's opinion, so it's not defamatory. And under the circumstances, the fact that he cited to the previous case or said that he had previously done it was simply a shorthand way of doing it. It wasn't a. It doesn't solve the problem of that we've gotten to at this point as to whether or not there's actually been an appeal of that opinion question in this case. And I would submit that there has not been.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.